Samaranzolo.
Let me expand a bit on Joe's thoughts. I agree with his list. I'd also agree that non-cash transactions ought to send off usually an alarm, and I'd like to think that that if an auditor finds a client that is lying to it, we'd like to refer to those usually as former clients. But again, a lack of controls in the area of related party transactions, which, of course, in an integrated audit, there will be some work around that. And even in a financial statement audit, I don't know how you audit related party transactions without understanding the company's controls. But even a lack of controls would, in my mind, be a fraud risk factor that ought to move an auditor into sort of a separate line of thinking. That doesn't mean it immediately moves you to forensics, but it ought to send off some lights, and you do have a higher risk.
Bob Tirola.
Yes, thank you. I agree with what most everyone has said, that related party transactions should be presumed to have an inherent risk different from unrelated party transactions. But I submit that if you look at your client's procedures around identification and monitoring of related party transactions, that you may find easy ways to audit the existence as well as the accounting implications. For instance, ethics certifications, conflict of interest certifications, transfer pricing policies, and the like, currency management policies. There are inherent controls around related party transactions that I think if you believe your client has a robust set of ways both to identify and to monitor, I think you'll feel better about the situation. If you don't see those controls, I'd say additional is probably a good word.
Randy Fletchall.
I want to respond to Dick's question. I think I may not have heard you correctly, but I thought I heard you say if the standard required an auditor to identify all related party transactions and then evaluate and understanding. I guess you posited that would an auditor drive up cost. I think clearly it would, but similar to our other discussions on SAS 99 in this forum, it also might be an impossibility. Cannot say you're required to identify every piece of fraud or every related party transaction. You can require one to seek to and go to great efforts to, but again, I think everyone realizes that there will be instances of collusive fraud that you just can't say it's a requirement that you would identify those. And we're back to kind of you're way beyond reasonable assurance into absolute assurance. And the cost, I think the price tag on that is bound to be prohibitive.
Damon Silvers.
Yeah, I too wanted to address Dick's question. I think, but first in response to what Randy said, I'm not sure anyone here is advocating an absolute liability scheme here. That's just not, for the reasons he stated, that's not a reasonable one. I think that certainly what I have in mind around this issue is that there should be some specific instructions as to how to proceed, not a rule that if some devious person is successful at somehow hiding something from you that you had no reasonable expectation of being able to find, that you're on the hook for that. I don't think anyone is advocating that. It struck me that the question you were asking was something like this: if you have a higher level of attention on the part of an audit standard to related party transactions, that there will be costs associated with audits there, and that assume for the moment that there are benefits associated with related party transactions, that they're being undertaken for good faith, for valid business reasons, right? That in some cases those audit costs will exceed the benefits associated with those transactions, and thus they wouldn't be undertaken. That's the hypothetical you posed to us. My reaction to that, which I think most investors would share, is that since you're sort of standing from this, you're standing outside this sequence of events without perfect knowledge about people's good faith and so on and so forth, that any transaction that's so economically marginal that the audit cost kicks it into the disadvantageous position, any related party transaction that's so economically marginal that characterization applies, is one that's not worth the risk that, in fact, it's not good faith.
Lynn Turner?
Certainly the mentioned by Sam and Joe about transactions with management being of concern, I think, is true. And again, if management hadn't told you about it, then Sam's right. It should be former client. Although I remember one a few years back that Bob's firm went out and said former client. Vince went out and said new client. So, you know, one man's loss is another man's gain. I think Bob won. But there's another type of transaction here that from a related party is, I think, even of more concern than the ones with management and require even more attention. And they are the structured transactions with the related party where people have structured them with that related party. We certainly saw that at Enron. We certainly saw it at AIG. In both cases, the auditors were aware of it. And we're now starting to see it pop through in securitizations. And we've seen it as securitizations, including some banks. And when people start doing these structured transactions with a related party to get a desired result, I think it even gets more heightened risk than one even with management. I would be more concerned about it. So I'd certainly have structured transactions on that list as well.
Thank you, Lynn. Any other comments on this question? Let's move ahead to the next couple of questions. The identification of undisclosed relationships is generally regarded as one of the most challenging aspects of an audit. Again, referring to the board's interim standard on related parties, AU Section 334, provides that auditors should be aware of the possibility that transactions with related parties may have been motivated by management to achieve certain financial results. This leads us to our final series of questions here on related parties. To what degree should the auditor be expected to search for and identify undisclosed related parties and transactions with those related parties? Are there certain procedures that the auditor should perform in each audit, or should the auditor be expected to determine those procedures based on the assessed risk of undisclosed matters? If based on risk, how should the auditor be directed to assess the risk of undisclosed related parties and related party transactions? Comments? Lynn Turner?
Greg, one thing I come back to in this area is from time to time we see where Wall Street has found the related parties, but the auditors don't. And the auditors seem to look at what's in front of them, and they don't go out and do the type of things that Wall Street does in terms and analysts do in terms of looking, especially with the Internet out there today. I find it more than interesting that analysts can find some related party stuff. There was some on Dell a couple of years ago. We found things where it's out there in public records and people just haven't gone and looked. Time and time again, we'll find a simple search on Google. We'll turn around and turn up things. So I'd ask that you turn around and reach out to some of the Wall Street people and take a look at what are they doing where they're able to identify these things and these relationships. But the auditors haven't, and I think it's because the auditors tend to audit what's in front of them and put in front of them and don't go out beyond that. And so I think that the steps that we're doing aren't sufficient. Quite frankly, then when you have an audit, you've had a significant related party. It was out there and Wall Street could find it, but the auditors couldn't find it. Every time the public is going to turn around and say, it's just not acceptable, and we want restitution. And if that's what the public, investing public in essence, is going to do and want, then you got to figure a way to get auditors out beyond just what's in front of them.
Cynthia Cooper?
Yeah, I was just going to add to what Lynn said about getting auditors to think out of the box. When we tested for related parties, looking for unidentified related parties at WorldCom, that's exactly what we did. We went out and got on the Internet and we Googled. And we looked for, you know, directors and officers and other associations. They may have companies they may be involved in where they, you know, they may have a percent ownership or whatever. And then we looked for the transactions. And we actually identified quite a few undisclosed related parties just by doing that. So I think it is important for auditors to think outside the box.
Bob Tirola?
Yes, and to that end, I would submit that the backdating was an undisclosed related party issue. And I think as auditors, you need to engage corporate counsel and outside counsel of the enterprise in a much more direct and robust way to ask some probing questions of the legal staff, who often, I believe anyway, could know much more about the insider transactions than frankly the CFO or the accounting staff. And so don't ignore that part of the organization.
Joe Carcillo?
I want to follow up on what Lynn said a little while ago. You might want to think about, too, whether it would be useful to provide guidance on how related party transactions might be designed to facilitate certain types of misstatements. It seems to me that structured transactions, as Lynn talked about, are probably most likely to be used to perpetrate fraudulent financial reporting. And self-dealing is really an issue of misappropriation of assets. And I think where that's particularly something to be concerned about, as I understand it, there's about 1,500 foreign registrants listed with the SEC. One of the characteristics of some of those foreign firms is that voting rights, in some cases, substantially exceed economic rights. And so one of the big governance issues with foreign firms, particularly closely held foreign firms, is tunneling, where essentially what will happen is the controlling shareholder, because they may have 80% of the votes but only 20% of the economic stake, they'll self-deal assets to a private company that they own 100% of the economic stake and essentially expropriate wealth from the corporation, the public corporation, to that private corporation. And I don't know how many U.S. auditors, given the context that we've been trained in, even tend to think that way.
Silvana Palmrose.
Oh, three items that probably don't relate to any of the questions you have here and may not relate to each other. But first of all, this topic was on the SAG agenda in 2004, and so it's one area where, again, we could ask the question or pose the question, what have we learned from the inspection process that would help us with this issue? Are there questions that have arisen in that context, and how would that inform the standard-setting process? The second point is from the paper, the Accounting Horizons paper, that is the synthesis paper on research in the area. I thought it was interesting in that it actually talks about an important distinction, which is whether related party transactions involve a disclosure issue or whether they involve a financial statement effect. And it turns out the disclosure to have an important role here. And so, again, thinking about the potential impact on standards, it seems to be important to think about whether we're talking about disclosure issues or whether we're talking about financial statement amounts. And then that relates to the third item, which is one of materiality. And one of the other issues that comes through not just this research paper but others is this issue of materiality with respect to disclosures versus financial statement effects. And again, thinking along those lines and how that relates to related party transactions may provide some insight from a standard setting process.
Bob Tubers.
You know, in thinking about this, there probably are definitely opportunities for us to do a better job in this arena. I mean, I haven't pored over all the commentary surrounding, ISO 550, but even that draft standard talks about, being alert for arrangements. That's very different than testing a list of related parties for understatement, specifically, positively testing. So I think what Lynn said, Cynthia, some others, I would think there's things we could do. I mean, alert would mean I'm sending out a confirmation. I happen to note that the public warehouse I'm sending the confirm to is the CEO's home address. You know, that would be alert. But, I mean, that's sort of like lucky. You know, you just have to put two and two together, and it doesn't, provide me a lot of comfort that there have been some positive audit steps taken to, I would say, to test that listing for understatement. So maybe there is some opportunity there.
Galen Hansen.
Again, dealing with smaller issuers, on the exchanges, there are now minimum equity requirements, and we're seeing from time to time companies dealing with related parties to try to write up assets, and the predecessor cost rules of the SEC have been around for quite some time. I would suggest that perhaps those could be somehow codified into the auditing standards. And then to follow up on Zovana's comments, I don't think it's just disclosure and financial statement effects. I think there's also a third category, and that would be the reporting requirements. I really question whether the auditor's report would be a place to reflect some of what's going on in the company. And to expand on that, you do occasionally see so many transactions. And let's face it, the measurement standard in accounting is supposed to be arm's length. And this gets thrown out the window with related party transactions. So when you're dealing with related party transactions, on occasion there are so many of them and they're so pervasive, you have to ask yourself whether the financial statements can be possibly presented fairly when they're riddled with related party transactions.
Others who would like to comment on this last series? Or any other comments? Lynn Turner?
Let me add one other criteria to think about, and that is geography. We've been talking about this from a U.S.-centric perspective. Anyone that's doing business in some of the emerging countries today realize that this is an extremely problematic issue for people in their business dealings. Knowing exactly what's going on with your marketing group and people in China, Russia, even Japan has had some problems. Korea certainly has had a lot of problems in this area as well. And we've had problems with, I think it was CNOC, the Korean Chaebols, Learnout House. We had some problems in this area. And people, especially when you have China, who has come out and said by law we're not going to do related party disclosures, we're not really going to adopt IFRS. And in fact, I had a meeting with representatives of the board of the largest telecom in China last November, and they came in and they said, Lynn, what do we do when the Chinese government asks us to do something that's not in the best interest of our minority shareholders? They control something like 75% or something like that. And so when you've got that attitude and culture out there, then I think you're in a whole new ballgame from an auditing perspective. You can't audit those companies the same way that we try to audit those companies here in the U.S. And if an audit firm is going to approach the audit of those companies where you got those type of cultures, and even the government has indicated that they're going to operate outside the boundaries of normal standards for the rest of the world, then you as an auditor, again, those aren't heightened awareness. Those are big-time problems, and I think they create some real audit issues, if not some real significant disclosure issues, because if you've got a government saying you don't have to disclose it, I don't know how an auditor in China these days is going to ensure that they've detected and disclosed all the related party transactions, because the government has said it's okay not to do that. And I think that is a very serious problem in the emerging countries and in China, especially with the government's position.
Any other comments or concluding comments on related parties? Okay, then we will move over to the next part and the last part of our meeting, and I'll turn it over to Tom Ray.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, everyone. So we'll move over into our discussion of emerging issues. As I mentioned this morning, we identified a couple of matters we would like to address, and it looks like we're going to have time to address both of them. Joining us up here is Marty Bauman. Marty is the director of our Division of Research and Analysis, or Office of Research and Analysis, I should say. Marty recently took the job succeeding Phil Wiedemeyer, who is another PCAOB senior staff who's decided to move on to other opportunities, and we're all going to miss Phil. I have to take the opportunity to say that and wish Phil the best of luck. But let me turn it over to Marty, who has agreed to tee up this issue for us. Thanks, Marty.
Great. Thanks, Tom. One of the areas that my office has been monitoring is the subprime mortgage market and the potential broader risks that might emerge from the warning signals being sent from that market. We would like to seek the input from this group on the potential threat of the subprime shakeout and what the auditing profession should be alert to and should be doing in connection with these potential risks. First, let me give some background information. Total mortgage debt outstanding for single-family homes was approximately $10 trillion at the end of 2006. Of that, subprime mortgage debt outstanding was about $1.2 trillion, and Alt-A mortgages, those are higher quality mortgages than subprime, but less so than conventional conforming mortgages, were about $700 billion, or combined those two categories were about $2 trillion, representing some 20% of the mortgage market. Bankruptcies and business failures of subprime mortgage companies have accelerated. In early 2007, New Century, the nation's second largest subprime lender, filed for bankruptcy, and to date, more than 30 other mortgage lenders have gone out of business. According to various sources, about $320 billion of the subprime mortgages remain on the balance sheets of the largest banks and mortgage originators. This implies over $800 billion in outstanding subprime mortgages are in securitizations and held by secondary mortgage investors. Problems are beginning to emerge with credit-related hedge funds and associated investment banks that have lending, counterparty, or other prime brokerage relationships with hedge funds. As recently as today, the press continues to report about the difficulties that two Bear Stearns-related hedge funds are experiencing after sustaining losses on subprime investments. These two funds are reported to have over $20 billion in investments, including mortgage-related securities and complex CDOs. One analyst today said that, quote, at best, this is an embarrassment for the firm, and at worst, it threatens to have a ripple effect on valuations across the subprime sector. Loan modifications are also being recommended as a key regulatory response that the banking and mortgage service industry should employ. The chairman of the FDIC recently called for the mortgage industry to modify subprime loans to the maximum extent possible rather than force foreclosures on homeowners. Securitization rules under FAS 140, however, which allow mortgage securitizations to be treated as sales with gain on sale recognition, may not permit such modifications. If FAS 140 rules are violated, this could result in a significant amount of mortgages coming back onto the balance sheets of the companies that originally securitized them. Further, there are many other mortgage-related assets that financial institutions hold which require regular valuation, including mortgage servicing rights, retained interest such as IO strips from securitizations, and loans held for sale. And finally today, the FG reported that the ABX derivative index, which tracks home loans made to subprime borrowers, dropped to a record low yesterday. So with that backdrop, I'd like to ask the group to address the following two questions. First, to what extent do you believe the troubles in the subprime mortgage market are signaling a significant financial reporting risk? Related to this is an implicit question of whether you foresee the troubles in subprime spilling over beyond the subprime lenders into mortgage securitizations, the broader mortgage market, other consumer debt, or other industries such as home builders. And second, if you believe there are significant danger signals and threats here and the potential for financial reporting risks, what advice would you give to the audit profession, and what should auditors be doing to be certain that financial reporting around these risks is fair, transparent, and appropriately audited? So with that, I'd like to ask the group to open the floor for comment and seek your input.
Lynn Turner. Leroy Dennis.
I want to add a third question to the list, because I get subprime lending now. There's all kinds of risks there, and we're all acute to it. And I can kind of make through in my mind, okay, it's going to affect housing and banking, and figure that out. What I think would be very valuable to the auditing profession and the business community is, what's the next subprime lending? What characteristics are out there in that group that relate to, that we see here, that are similar in another industry, so that we can predict that we ought to be looking closer at that industry as opposed to a retrospective look-back rule on subprime lending. So I would add a third question to your list.
Damon Silvers.
Well, I'll respond to Leroy's question, which is that I think that what we are seeing here in part, let me say first, in terms of what you should be looking at, I think you've already identified it. From what I can tell, the key issue here is who's got the puts, and where are they being recognized, and where are their hidden puts back, and so who's really going to end up holding this paper? That seems like the critical question here. The question of what does this tell us about sort of more embedded risk in the credit system or in other places, which is in a way Leroy's question. I think the thing that the board ought to be attentive to, the staff ought to be attentive to, is the fact that this is one element of a larger issue which has been identified by the OECD economic staff on several occasions in the last year, which is the problem of compressed risk spreads in long-term credit markets globally, particularly dollar-denominated long-term credit markets. And I believe this is a very large dollar-denominated long-term credit market, and clearly risk spreads have been sufficiently compressed in this market that a lot of money went out into situations where perhaps maybe it shouldn't have or on different terms. Given that that's the case, where else are those sorts of conditions present? Where else may a lot of money have been put out on fixed income terms, where in fact the risks are much greater than the pricing under which that money was put out? I think there's some rather obvious places, and one of them is leveraged buyouts of public companies. And the second is hedge funds, and there may be thirds and fourths, but those are the two that I'm paying attention to, and the dollars involved in both are trillions.
Other comments? Oh, excuse me, Lynn Turner.
Marty, this is starting to feel all too much like what we saw for those of us who went through the 80s and the real estate problems. This is deja vu all over. And I remember when we initially had legislation that allowed the S&S to start getting into this type of lending. And then when it started to go south on us because the way the interest rate flips, people not managing their balance sheets in the S&L industry, then things started going really bad on us in terms of cash flows coming in on those loans. And the initial reaction and the continued reaction for several years of the banking regulators were consistent with what we're seeing from the FDIC and the banking regulators now. First of all, they put a lot of pressure on the accounting firms, the standard setter, the professional as a whole, to turn around and make exceptions or waive the rules or make accommodations such that the financial statements of those S&Ls didn't reflect economic reality. At the same time that the then comptroller of the GAO was testifying saying, we got a problem and it's a growing problem. And the GAO would go up and constantly, time after time, say we had a problem. And banking regulators would go up and say, don't worry about it. Okay, we'll be okay. And eventually they came around to the GAO's way of thinking, but we all paid $500 billion out plus to rectify that. We're now starting.
That was following the election. In other words, both parties were involved, so nothing was done until after the presidential election.
Right. And so here we've got even senior members of Congress involved now in writing letters to the FASB, asking once again for accommodation on the accounting rules. Because clearly under 140, if you've got the ability to go back in and gain control of the receivables, you haven't sold them. I mean, it's principle. It's very principle. You ain't sold them. You still control them. They should be on your balance sheet. And yet we're finding that there's contracts being written by the mortgage servicers that say you have exactly that right. If things go bad and you have to go back and redo them and you have to go back and modify them, you didn't sell them. And yet the banking regulators are once again pressuring the accounting firms and the FASB to make that accommodation so that the financial statements, once again, just like in the 80s, aren't reflecting economic reality to investors. And I find that to be extremely disappointing. And I would certainly hope that the audit firms and profession, the FASB, would turn around and say no to that so we don't have a repeat of what we had before it. We should learn and not repeat the mistakes. And members of Congress who were out there just a year or two ago running around saying, let's defend the independence of the FASB, are the exact same ones now writing letters to the FASB saying, go make these accommodations. That's outrageous. The other thing then is on the securitizations, and we've seen this now for a number of years, it appears like the audit partners haven't really got in some instances and understood the contracts
and the specific terms of some of these securitizations and understood that in reality some of these contracts perhaps haven't met the requirements of FAS 140. And I think especially in light of what's coming down, the firms have to be very careful that audit partners who can understand these are very complex, extremely complex agreements, that they've gone in and done their homework on these agreements so they know which ones are legitimate off-balance sheet securitizations and which ones aren't. Because what I heard up on the Hill just yesterday indicated to me that we've got audit partners that haven't recognized terms and contracts that probably didn't qualify for 140, and now as they're starting to look at them with this heightened attention, they're finding, oops, I've got errors and I got to fix them. I hope we get those errors fixed. The last piece of it is, as you mentioned, Marty, we've certainly seen Bear Stearns and Goldman start to take some write-downs and some hits here. Before that, we saw Fremont General and some others. It's tough to believe that we don't have other people in the same position. And what happened in the 80s was we got bled to death, which is really what was the GAO's point all along, is people are trickling this in and trying to hide the losses rather than really show investors what the true losses were. And as a result, people hid, really didn't manage to loss, and it ended up costing us a whole lot more. I would hope in this case the firms who are auditing these type of institutions aren't going to allow that bleeding. People are really getting in and getting the data on these subprimes and understanding the risk, the type of loans that were being made, who the loans were being made. I know some members of Congress have turned around and said, well, we need to allow them to modify them and still keep them off the balance sheet because that'll help keep people in their homes. That isn't what's going to help keep people in loans. Their ability to make payments on loans where there's escalating interest rates or they didn't have enough equity in solving that problem is what will solve the problem. The accounting doesn't solve or put people in their homes on this issue.
Mark Olson?
Let me just make a couple of observations on the broad subject to help then focus on what I think is a really important question, and I think Leroy's question and Damon's response are really important. What should we now look for in this area? The one significant difference, let me back up. For most of consumer mortgage history, in recent years there have been two kinds of loans, conforming and non-conforming. The conforming product was the Fannie and Freddie product that Marty is extremely well familiar with. It was very carefully underwritten, and as a result, and securitized. And securitization of conforming product was a pretty good relationship, and it performed exceptionally well for both for the market and for the individuals. The non-conforming product, including the Alt A's, is a very old product. Alt A's have been around for 25 years, so it wasn't that the products themselves were new. But what was new was that the secondary market was started to warm up to the non-conforming product. And whereas previously the non-conforming product was always kept on the portfolio of the lender and not sold, therefore there was some rigor to the underwriting even in this non-conforming product. But as soon as the secondary market started to buy it, the originators no longer had any reason to be prudent in terms of the way they were underwritten. And the term came, we underwrite to the market. So whatever the market would buy, the originators would underwrite to. And that's where you got the collapse in the spreads. So as you look at where you will get and for that reason also, most of the serious losses will be outside the banking system because the bank regulators were pretty good about looking at whether or not the underwriting had some rigor to it. So most of it will be out of the banking system. But there will be a tremendous amount of that problem credit that's spread out throughout the market, the enormous amount of liquidity available in the secondary market meant that a lot of that product had been purchased. So it's going to be interesting to see where it does a fallout. Prospectively, you'd have to look at the same formula, same calculus. Where is there an element where the risk is not appropriately priced, or not evaluated at all that is going on? And I tend to think that Damon's probably right, at least in the LBO and the hedge fund market. Maybe where would be next? But certainly there was no mystery with the mortgage product itself, the subprime product, that we were headed for this kind of an event.
Leroy Dennis.
Just to add what Mark said, as I thought through this as to what other industries could experience this kind of issue, and I think when you have a situation where, how Mark described, where when you were making loans in the past, the underwriter had risk of default, and today they don't. And so I think it's prudent as we think through this, what other industries are out there? Do you have a sales process that really doesn't have any skin in the game once they get the sale closed? And that might be where we find other instances like this, where you have a potential disconnect and somebody that's overselling the market, so to speak.
One comment I just want to make, Lynn, to your earlier statement about, I had mentioned 140 and you brought it up. I understand there's a meeting, and Ed Trott's not here. There's a meeting at FASB on Friday to discuss the loan modification issue. And so I take to heart your concerns that hopefully the rules stay as the rules are.
FASB has put out some stuff to tee up that issue, so hopefully the FASB won't bend. I mean, they were pretty good, and actually the firms were very good during the 80s when the banking regulators kept asking them for accommodations. It's just that it's sad that we've got the regulators who pound on the auditors when they don't do a good audit of a financial institution, now pounding on them to give them accommodations and breaks from the rules. It puts the auditing profession in kind of a darned if you do and a darned if you don't, and a real roller coaster. It's unfortunate that the banking regulators are doing this to the profession all over again. Just 20 years after it cost us all $500 billion.
Is there any more comment on this particular issue? That was very helpful. Okay, it's been a long day, I know. There is one more thing I would like to get some advice from you on, if you'd like to provide it. As I mentioned, our next meeting of the Standing Advisory Group, which is going to take place in October, is our annual meeting, and that is the meeting where we ordinarily will bring to you staff's views on what our priorities ought to be for the upcoming year. And I thought, since we have a little bit of time this afternoon, if you have some thoughts you'd like to share with us in advance as to what you think our priorities ought to be, the staff would welcome those thoughts at this point. So I'll just open the floor up.
Joe Carcillo.
Yeah, I have a couple of things you might want to think about. One is, you guys have been in existence now for about 5 years, and you adopted the Auditing Standards Board standards through 102 as interim standards. Are they going to stay interim forever? It probably would be useful for the market to have some sort of a path to resolution of that status. A second issue is you adopted them through SAS 102. In the interim, the Auditing Standards Board has issued standards through SAS 114. Superseding the previous standards, so you could make an argument that 12 of the standards that are now in effect for the audits of private companies, which are arguably better than the standards for audits of public companies, which is 12% of the existing interim standard base, that's a pretty significant percentage. And so there may be some usefulness in looking at 103 through 114, and either you probably won't adopt them, but come up with your own standard in those spaces. A second area would be confirmations. I know it's on the agenda for this year, but I think I think there needs to be further guidance on that. I think the guidance on that, or at least how it's being implemented, is seriously flawed all the way from, it's not obvious to me that in most cases audit firms know the address they're given is legitimate. When I was in public accounting, we just took it from the client. We never really questioned it. How do you know you're given the right person to send the confirmation to? How do you know the right person is responding? Side agreements have been a pervasive issue over the years. So I think there's a whole host of questions surrounding confirmations. And then the last issue would, again, tie back to George's group. You have 3 or 4 years now of inspection reports and a kind of a comprehensive analysis of where those inspection findings indicate problems with standards rather than problems with performance might really inform the board, I think, in a very useful way as to where new standards or modifications of existing standards need to be made.
Damon, do you have your card up? Damon Silvers.
Investors have, I think, for a long time been concerned about the fraud standard. And I'm sure that my fellow investor representatives would echo that point of view. Since Tiles have the mic on, I want to say that it's noteworthy that this will be a time when hopefully the AS2, AS5 issue will not be among the things that you have to think about. And I wanted to convey it both on behalf of the people I represent and on behalf of myself, our appreciation and gratitude for the work of the board and the staff around that issue. I think the deafening silence when it finally came out was really testimony to what fine work was done in somewhat difficult circumstances.
Thanks, Damon. Let me ask you a quick follow-up question with regard to the fraud standard. I sort of view it as two parts. One, sort of the conceptual auditor responsibility, the description of what the auditor is responsible for discovering, you know, reasonable assurance, et cetera, and the practical application or the approach to addressing fraud. And I wonder if you were thinking about it in terms of one or the other or both.
Well, I mean, I was thinking about it in terms of both. I think that when we've discussed this in this body, I think that there's been a pretty uniform opinion among folks coming from the investors' sort of side of things that the current standard has a conceptual, there is a conceptual problem hidden in the current standard, and then once you dealt with that, that you'd want to have to elaborate as to what that means in practice, and so I think unfortunately you have to do both here, and of course, you know. Some people say, well, you know, it's really unfair and inappropriate to demand that auditors find all fraud, right? One hears that whenever this subject comes up, and I don't think anybody's looking for that. That's not the point. The point is that this is not an absolute liability issue, but this is an issue about setting a level of reasonable inquiry here, and I don't think the investor community thinks that level is currently there in the standard, but I invite my friends, colleagues who, again, come from the investor perspective to weigh in here in case I've got the nuances wrong.
Lynn Turner? I think we'd like at least the $1 billion frauds found. Good starting point. I say, Tom, go back and look at that original letter that the investor reps of the SAG group, maybe you want to circulate that again, originally sent in. The fraud standard, as Damon mentioned, was on there. Improving the communication between the auditors and investors in the form of the report was on there. Some of them that you teed up today, I think related parties was on there and fair value was on there. And there was, I think, a fifth one on there that escapes me. What was it?
Revenue recognition.
Maybe revenue recognition was on there. But I'd go back and take a look at that one. I think it probably still pretty well holds true. The other piece is I suspect by springtime, you'll have some recommendations out of the Treasury
audit committee as well. And so you may want to be thinking about if those come in that time frame, how you're interfacing with that and that, how that might impact your priorities going down the roads. So I think that could all of a sudden, before it's all said and done, have a play here with the whole thing.
Bob Torella?
Yes, my comment is consistent with Lynn's about looking at the standard audit report, and especially as it relates or doesn't relate to the standard officer certification. The two are quite different in language and content. I find that kind of odd. And then also, as we move into this interactive data world, how will the auditor be willing to be associated with my financial statements when they're released in bits instead of as a whole? I think that's. I know that the AICPA is thinking through that, but just filing an interactive statement, it caught my attention that that I would like to have an auditor extension, if you will, associated with the data as it would flow through the information supply chain instead of just flowing through without any auditor attachment.
Bob Kippers?
I think this discussion is anticipating where you're going to be in October, so the annual priorities that you go through. I'd recommend that you take off the list engagement quality review. Take it off because by then it'll be finished, so you won't have to put it on. That would be helpful. I think we've all been anticipating the completion of that project, and I gather it's in some relatively advanced stage.
We appreciate that optimism.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, at some point you just gotta do it. So. I also think that, you know, again, whether you want to call it convergence or leverage, the board has to determine its own priorities with input, absolutely. But, you know, let's face it, you've got a high talent but relatively modest size staff. And so only so much can get done, you know, in sort of a linear approach. But if you were to piggyback off some of the thinking of John Kellis's group, or the IAASB, excuse me, and even understanding, you know, how does this, even the ASB, which is, you know, in a different space, determine which are priority projects, you know, looking at all that might lead to some alignment and then maybe some efficiencies in terms of joint projects or whatever. I think anything that would signal that kind of cooperation would probably be good for investors.
Any other comments?
Okay, well, thank you very much. The meeting has exceeded my expectations. I appreciate all of your advice and input, and we look forward to seeing you in October. Thank you.